This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Fantastic to have you with us on the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. On today's episode, a real look at some health challenges, both mental and physical. The red flags to look out for when it comes to skin cancer. Plus, how to talk to your children about puberty. The talk. When to have it, what to say, what not to say. And how to deal with their issues if they come home with some incorrect information. And in our psychology hour, Dr. Thrai was on hand to talk about some very actionable, realistic ways to boost your mental health. We've got Irene Gerges with us today. She's the founder of Kids Summit. She is a child behavioural and parenting coach. She's got a child psychology diploma. She's a former teacher as well, and she has lived all over the place. Egypt, US, UAE. So she's worked with children from all sorts of different cultures and countries. And their parents too, facing various challenges. She is licensed by the KHDA and aims to fill the gap between what we maybe should be learning and what we're not learning when it comes to our kids with coaching sessions and tools. We're talking about puberty today and how to have that conversation with your kids. Irene, thank you so much for being with us. How are you?
Thank you for having me. I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm really well, really, really well. I find this a bit of an awkward one because I think I picked up most information from a magazine called Just 17. And my husband was simply put a can of deodorant on his bedside table by his parents. That was the one. That was them having the chat. So I feel like everyone's got had those moments of, oh my goodness, I can't believe my parents are going to sit down and try to talk to me about, you know, changing bodies and how babies are made. But there is, you know, over the next hour, we're going to be talking about how to navigate that conversation. Before we talk about that, and I've had a number of messages and questions because a lot of people are getting to grips with what their own feelings are before they share it with their kids. But before we get to that, I wanted to ask about some of the areas you work on in general and what your aims are in terms of Kids Summit bridging that gap.
Sure. So working as a teacher, I just stepped back a bit after 8 years and I thought, okay, these children need more than the reading, writing and math that I'm teaching them. So then I started studying the psychology and coaching specifically on children ages from 5 till 18 years old. And then I focused more about the basic life skills that the children need, whether it's self-acceptance, self-confidence, defending ourselves, dealing with bullying, communication skills, social skills, and how to win friends, and different perspectives, and how can we agree to disagree, and it doesn't always have to be my way or the highway. Mm. So all these skills that make successful adults, I started teaching the kids from a young age, which I feel this world will make a better future for them.
For them and for everybody, hopefully.
Yes.
Can I ask then, what are lots of families coming to you with right now? What are you identifying as areas where families are struggling, perhaps?
Yeah, so the main thing is the media addiction, I have to say, or devices addiction, screen times. And the other one that's very upsetting is the self-confidence. Mm-hmm. Children, just because they're continuously on social media, so they're always comparing themselves with others, and they're comparing the amount of likes and follows and all that, and that definitely affects their self-confidence and self-acceptance. So these are the two main concerns.
And with that, is that a teen thing? Is it even a preteen thing? When we're talking about tech and devices, I think about, you know, even YouTube Kids, and you know, you've got much younger children using that.
Yeah, from 5 and 6 years old, we start with this screen addiction. And with the confidence issue, it starts as young as 8 and 9 years old because they are exposed to so many media and sources around them, mm-hmm. which just automatically tells them that I'm not good enough or I don't fit in.
I would love to explore that on another day. Today, though, we're having the talk about the talk.
Sure.
So we are discussing puberty, and I'm curious to know how your parents addressed it, if at all, or was it something that was taught at school? Go on, delve down the, get into the memory banks and let us know on 4001. Can I ask you then, why is it important to have the talk with our kids?
Sure. So the main thing is that you are in charge of what your children will know. You will tell them what they need to hear in the right, correct format. And you will have this bond and connection, Helen, with them that there's no way you can receive from any other conversation or any other outing. And no matter how much you try to bond with them, this kind of bond is so special. And that's why I always urge parents to be the ones to talk to their children. Mm-hmm. Yes, here in schools sometimes, or most of the schools have the puberty talk with the children, but it's the parents' responsibility to have this connection with them.
Because presumably, even if that conversation does happen at school, children might not feel comfortable putting their hands up and asking questions they might have. So maybe it needs to be a continuation into the home as well. I like this point that you are the gatekeeper of that information, because, you know, age is so, especially when you're looking at what kind of, you know, 8 to 12, for example, you can have incredibly emotionally mature and physically developed children, and you can have some that, are, you know, perhaps aren't ready for certain amounts of information. Yeah. When do you tend to recommend starting to introduce the topic of puberty?
So we start talking about our reproductive system from a very young age in a very respectful way and very relaxed way. And from as young as 2 and 3 years old, I start naming these body parts with their scientific names. We tend to call them like all these weird nicknames. Mm-hmm. And this indirectly tells the children that these are not okay body parts, or they're shameful, or we shouldn't be talking about them. So from as young as to when they start knowing about the eyes and the ears, then they start talking, knowing about the penis and the vagina, and there's nothing wrong with it. We need to normalize talking about
I think there's the normalization piece, but there's also the worst case scenario piece in terms of communication, and in case something or someone is touched and a child is able to explain exactly what happens.
This is the next step, yes. So we start by talking about these body parts and saying that they are special and private body parts, and that's why we cover them up with bathing suits when we go to the to the beach or the pool. And then the next level, we start talking about how important and special and precious these parts are, and that we have to keep them very safe. And we start talking about safe and unsafe touch. It doesn't have to be good or bad. It doesn't have to be in only these private parts, but just an unsafe touch in general. It could be a hug. Mm-hmm. It could be a kiss from someone. So we start then taking the following step of feeling safe. And what does it mean if my body is not feeling safe? If I'm getting these goosebumps or tummy ache or my body is not feeling right,
then
I'm not safe.
So kind of trusting that instinct and introducing the concept of consent as well.
Yes, exactly. Yes. So and the following step is consent. Did that person, even if he's a family friend or a family member, did he ask to kiss you? Did he ask to hug you? Did you say yes? And next time you have the right to say no. And parents need to support their children. If they say, I don't want to see this man or this woman or my aunt or my uncle, the parents should really respect that. And because we tend as parents to tell them, no, it's okay. He just loves you. It's because he loves you. He wants to give you a kiss. But we really need to respect what the children are feeling. And if they didn't give a consent, then it's a no. Then we take it further from that and start explaining that it's the body, the male body parts and the female body parts. Even if she's a girl, yes, I explain to her body parts, and then I go ahead and introduce the male body parts. It's not because she doesn't have a brother, then I don't talk about it. So for boys and girls, I need to talk about all different body parts and reproductive system, and why is it created this way and why happens.
Irini Girgis is with us. She's the founder of Kids Summit. She hosts workshops, offers coaching tools. You've taken kids to the desert for some big conversations, Irini. Tell us about that.
Desert, mountain, beaches. Because I'm an outdoor person, and I do believe that living in this part of the world is hindering children from being outdoors. So that's why most of the camps, when weather permits, I take the children to these outdoor places. And I have to tell you, they are like in awe. They love it. They don't complain. They even teenagers, they just become kids again. And they roll down the dunes and they are laughing. And so it's just the best setting than just hiring or renting an indoor place to just give a workshop.
So. Different headspace.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about changing bodies. When it comes to when to talk to our children about it, I think for me at school, we started talking, we were kind of 11, 12, and I feel like a lot of children are actually starting puberty a whole lot earlier now. And we've actually had a message here saying, I wish someone had spoken to me earlier. I honestly thought I was dying. Talk to us about the timing.
So there's no magic time, Helen. It's when the children are curious and ready, and they are curious by nature, and there's nothing wrong with them asking questions, then I have to give them the answer whenever it is. If they asked at 3, 4, 5 years old, I need to give them all the answers they need. And the earlier, the better. The younger kids are exposed to this information, the more innocent they are, and they keep their innocency. Opposite to what parents think, oh, they're going to break out of their innocence and they're going to start searching. And no, not really, because they take it as just facts, scientific facts, that there's nothing wrong with it. So I don't have to wait for them to come and ask me, because if I wait, that means they've received something or they heard something distorting. And then now I'm fixing something that got mixed up or got ruined. So better to give them that proper clean image. And I'm in charge, as I said, of what we say. And if I want to add any culture, religion, belief in there, then I go ahead and say it. Much better than waiting for them to come and ask me, what's this word? Or I saw this picture. And then I start fixing something that got damaged.
That makes a lot of sense. A message here is saying, I fear that if I teach my 4 children the correct body part names, they will no doubt repeat these words inappropriately in public or school in a joking way, which would not go down well.
It's better than repeating those nicknames and joking about as well, because the way I talk about this, I tell them that this is very respectful and this is very special, this is very private, and we need to respect these. Yes, media shows these contents in a very inappropriate way just because they want to have more followers, they're money makers, it's business. But in reality, this is not the case. And I ask them to not talk about these with their friends. But even if they talk, at least they have the correct and clean image that was their first. It's really better than fixing something disgusting that they have received from their friends.
Okay, so to the text line. N says, what if their friends tell them first? My daughter is 9 and is recently starting saying some very inaccurate things that have come from a friend about body parts. Should I speak to the friend's parents?
You should speak to your daughter and give her the correct information and tell her that people sometimes get information from unreliable sources, and this is not what we rely on. And you can then fix that distorted image or wrong information that your daughter has. And if you talk to her friend's parents, she might hear it from another friend, and then later on she will hear it from another person. So you are in charge and in control of your own child to let them understand the whole process in the correct way.
Can I ask you, and I say this as a British person who has a very British husband, and as I said, he never had that talk. How do you get over your own embarrassment as a parent?
So this is, yes, the first step. First, you need to understand that there's nothing wrong with the talk. There's nothing embarrassing about it. It's how we were brought up is what makes us in this place. So sit and talk to yourself first. Convince yourself that there's nothing wrong with, you haven't done anything wrong. This is how the body works. And then when you start accepting this, it will really help you and help your tone of voice into talking with your children.
It's practice as well, isn't it?
Yes, it's practice and just acceptance, Helen. It's just you need to accept that there's nothing wrong with the talk. There's nothing wrong with our bodies working this way. So why am I embarrassed? There's nothing to be embarrassed about.
I know, but I think a lot of people, depending on their parents or their culture, that there is an amount of shame, whether it is around, you know, periods or hair, and you know. So, what about how do you navigate that? As I said, you've worked in the US and here in Egypt as well. Any kind of cultural sensitivities that you think
definitely
are worth highlighting?
Oh, definitely. Being like in this part of the world or in Egypt, there's definitely a lot of taboos about talking about these topics, and it's really the parents, and every time I talk to the parents, they feel like, no, we can't do this. And I'm like, why can't you? You were brought up this way, and you're complaining from the way you were brought up that no one had told you, and you just found out through a friend or a magazine or a video. Why are you doing this to your children? So it's just a conscious decision, Helen, that we as adults and parents need to make, that we need to step back, get over our fears and our taboos so we can help our children, not let them go through what we went through.
I think it's also never been so important when we think about the information and imagery that our children do have access to because of the internet and because of devices. So as you say, if we're proactive, there's going to be an element of proper education.
Yes, and I have to say 9 is a bit late. Like, we start as early as 5 and 6 and 7 years old now.
I mean, in our family, so I've got a 6-year-old and an 8-year-old, and I have no privacy. And because I'm too tired to lie, my children have known pretty much everything from day one.
Yes, and
but then I worry that they're going to be the ones that are kind of, you know, going out and sharing this information and perhaps shocking the children.
But let me go back. When you talked to them about all the, did you feel like they were like, ew and disgusting?
No. And do you know what's interesting? I was trying to talk to my 8-year-old about periods of the day because I'd introduced the topic a while ago. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I was just wondering if you've got any questions. She was like, not really. But here's what I wanted to ask you. When she is asking about, you know, does it hurt to have a baby? Or why does a lady's tummy hurt when she has a period? I don't want to frighten her. So what's appropriate in that respect?
Yeah, so we need to be as clear as possible. So it's not hurting to the point of like you're going to die or whatever. It's like as if you have a muscle ache in your arm or you twisted your arm a little bit or you over-exercise. So it's the kind of pain that you can tolerate and it's not the scary one. But you can't tell her that, no, it doesn't hurt and it's fine. And no, we really have to be very clear and very honest with them.
Irene Gerges is the founder of Kids Summit. She's a child behavioural and parenting coach. She has a background in child psychology, in coaching and teaching as well. She has lived all over the world, Egypt, the US, and here, of course, working with children from all sorts of different cultural backgrounds and countries who facing all sorts of different challenges. And today we are talking about how to talk about puberty, about being age appropriate, about being the gatekeeper to the right information for your child at the right time. We've just been addressing getting over your own embarrassments and hang-ups. And a message here from Jamie that actually came through on social media saying, do you think it's best for mums to speak to girls and dads to boys, or does it not really matter? Good question.
It doesn't really matter, Helen. Actually, the best scenario would be mum and dad talking to the child, because as we said, there's nothing embarrassing in that. There's nothing wrong with that. We have gone through that process together to get the baby. So it really, really adds a lot of value and a lot of weight when both parents talk to their children. If worst case scenario, if one of the parents is not available or is not convinced, then the other parent would take over. Whether it's a boy or a girl, it just really doesn't matter.
Gabby's saying, I've never got the talk idea. It makes everything into a thing, and it's not a thing. It's just part of life. My daughter's 6, and she's seen me in the bathroom. I've told her all about the lining of the womb, etc. It comes up often, and my overall aim is to make it normal and talked about and completely eradicate the need for any embarrassment about anything ever.
Sure. My son is 22 years old now. I remember we had that conversation when he was 7. And I had some books, like cartoonish, but explaining everything. And he was like, okay, fine. And he just took it very lightly, just very few questions. And then a couple of months later, for some reason, I thought, okay, maybe he just didn't get it.
Yeah.
So I called him in again. I'm like, Anthony, daughter. He's like, yeah, I know, mom. So what's wrong? Like, there's nothing wrong
with
that.
You're making it a thing.
Exactly. So I'm like, okay, fine. So he got it. Same with my daughter. They just, because it was my husband, myself, and we talked about everything so openly. So it was just normal.
Jennifer's got a book recommendation saying, My Body Belongs to Me.
Yes.
Great for young ages, teaching about consent and what parts are private and what touch is welcome versus unwelcome. Uh-huh. I've also used this on the subject of bullying. My Body Belongs to Me. Thank you for that. We've got one called My Amazing Body, which is very like a picture book for very, very little ones. And honestly, at 6 and 8 now, my kids have grown out of it. So I think I need to, you know, now that they're able to read independently, but maybe it's something you read together as well. What do
yes.
you think?
Yes, sure. It adds a lot of connection and value as well. There's a book called The Stork as well. It's quite interesting with a lot of information. I think it's for 5 years and up.
I'll have a little nosy.
Yes.
No name on this message saying, I have a 9-year-old boy who's never shown much interest or asked anything about growing up or babies. I was waiting for his questions, but they haven't arrived. I think I need to start the conversation. So any advice with boys?
It's always better to ask them what they know first, so that we are aware on what they know, what they don't know, if it's correct information or incorrect. If he's refusing to answer, then it would be like, okay, this is what happens. This is the body parts for a female. This is the body part for male. And you go ahead and do all the talk. There are some children who refuse to have this talk and they like, no, and they run away or they just close their ears. Mm. And this could be a sign that they have a very distorted, disgusting image that they don't want to talk about or hear about anymore. So if that's the case, if they're not ready today, then we go ahead and try in a couple of days. But we really have to have that talk for them to know that there is nothing wrong and you are a safe space for them to come back and ask any question if needed.
That's my kind of overall parenting goal, to be honest. Apart from raising, you know, decent, kind humans, it's to maintain that communication. Yes. And there's this quote that I always come back to, which is, you know, you've got to listen to little things when they're little.
Yes.
So they'll
yes.
tell you the big things when they're big.
Sure. And if we talked about this, then there's anything else we can talk about. Because we've already talked about the talk, then we can talk about anything else.
We've had a message asking about body odour and when that starts. Interesting, as I said. I think it's completely individual, and I think puberty is, I'm no doctor, but I've heard from many a doctor that it perhaps is starting earlier than ever before. What's been your experience?
So with girls, it starts from as early as 9 till 13, 14. With boys, it can start from 10, 11. But again, it's just, it depends. Each body is different. So we don't have to really wait for them to hit puberty and then start talking to them about it.
Well,
they need to be ready for it. They need to know that hair will come out in these areas. They need to know that they will start bleeding. They need to know that they will start smelling. Not just like, oh my God, what's happening? I'm disgusting.
Well, that was Patrick's point earlier, saying, I wish that someone had told me earlier, I thought I was dying.
Yeah.
But I think that hygiene piece is actually really important as well.
Yes.
About, you know, it comes again back to kind of self-respect and body image.
Yes.
Is there anything you've got in your kind of toolkit when it comes to making sure that preteens are... Yeah, ready. The bathroom shelf is prepared.
Because the phase before that, which is 8 and 9 years old, this is the phase where they're refusing to shower. And it's always a fight, especially with boys. So it's always good to have that habit. And it doesn't have to be a fight every single time. It just, if we have it as a routine, then instead of showering every day, then we can have it every other day if it's really a battle at home.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to explain to them that it's for their safety. And it's not just people will get disgusted if they smell your whatever, sweat.
Yeah.
It's not about people feeling this, about you being clean and being hygiene. So we need to, yes, prepare them and provide all the deodorants and shower gel and all that.
Stuff.
But you know what, Helen, what's funny is that when you see especially a guy showering on his own twice a day, then you know that, oh, he's starting to have that crush with a girlfriend. That's the sign.
That will get the action.
Yeah.
Okay. Can I ask you then, what about helping with siblings? Because we've got this 2-year gap between my girls, and I know the younger one is starting to be like, oh, she's getting older, oh, she's starting to develop, and teasing. So any advice there in terms of dealing with that sibling dynamic or cousins where, you know, maybe a boy is starting to smell or get hair or, you know, nighttime emissions or a girl has got her period and the younger ones are starting to find that hilarious.
Well, we need to then have that respectful talk. And remember, we need to respect because the body is changing and you will go through this at some point as well. And it's not funny. This is how the body works. And we start explaining to the little ones a little bit about puberty and talks and look at the changes. What changes can you see? And yes, this is very good. This is exciting. You also will be having this. We just need to let the children be comfortable in their own bodies because you tend, especially with girls, when they start getting, the breasts are getting bigger, they start bending down and they don't want to wear anything tight and they start wearing baggy stuff because they are embarrassed from their breasts growing. So we really need to make the children comfortable in their own bodies.
Irini, I think we can squeeze in one last question that came in saying, how do I be a friend and a mum at the same time? Sometimes she'll tell me lots and sometimes she won't tell me anything and the attitude is changing. I'm only human, please help.
You are a mum, you are not a friend. You can parent to their kids.
Thank you.
You can parent your children in a friendly way, but you are the parent. There is no way your daughter or your son will hear from you the same comments they will hear from their friends. There has to be a difference. So those parents who live or fear that, oh no, I need to be cool and just not disciplined just because I want her to come and tell me everything, I want to be her friend. No, you are not her friend, you are her mom, and there has to be boundaries and there has to be consequences, and she needs to know that you you are the mom, you have authority. Yes, you are friendly. Yes, you are kind. Yes, you are firm, but you are not her friend. So when we have this load off our shoulder that we need to be our kid's friend, then parenting will take the right path.
Mm-hmm. And kids respond well to boundaries. They need that.
And they need to understand that you are the mom, and sometimes you are going to put your foot down mm-hmm. and just let it be what you want, because you know better, you know their safety, you are the mom. So
or dad.
I know that sometimes we have those Instagram moms, like, oh, my daughter's my best friend.
No, like, that's weird. Get a friend your own age.
Yeah, so my daughter now, she's 20, and yes, the connection has started to build. I think when she was 18 and 19, this is when we started, and she started asking about my advice, but we're not best friends.
No, and
we are, yes, we're talking, but we can't be best friends. Yeah. We are a mom and daughter relationship.
I often think that if I met my mum and we were the same age, I would be friends with her because I like her as a person.
Yes.
But I like her more as my mum, and that's appropriate. Thank you so much for your time, Irini. For anyone that wants to get in contact with you, you can be found at Kids Summit. And if you want to send me the word kids, I'd be very happy to send you the link. There's all sorts of information resources in there, but also, you know, more about what you do in terms of working with families, going into schools, working with groups as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Really, really valuable conversation. And
thank
I hope,
so
hope we can all get over our embarrassment. For
taboo.
Yeah, exactly that. So if you do want the details, 4001, I'd be very happy to send you Irini's details. The Middle East destination wedding market is estimated to be around 4 billion euros worth, and increasing numbers of couples are heading down the aisle, leading to Dubai. Now, we all love a good wedding. Organising one, however, is a whole different experience, and one woman that can speak firsthand about it is Zeynep Al-Saleh. She is an event planner, mum of three, and now the author of a book called A Carousel of Weddings, From Dubai with Love. I'm so curious how you got into this. How are you, Zeynep?
Hi, Helen. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for asking. I'm really excited to talk to you because you've got an incredible reputation and I want to know a little bit about behind the scenes. But before we get to weddings in Dubai, how did you come to have this as a career?
Well, it wasn't something that I've dreamt of. I didn't grow up thinking I wanted to be a wedding planner. I come from a very traditional family. I'm the eldest of four, the only girl. And when I graduated from high school, my father's dream was for me to become a banker.
Uh-huh. This wasn't your dream?
No. Okay. It was my father's dream. You know, Middle Eastern families tend to be very traditional that way. And I'm a people pleaser, which works well for what I do now. So I did go to business school and I graduated and I started my career in banking. I worked in banking for a few years and then realized that it wasn't really what I wanted to do. It wasn't something that was making me happy. Around that time, I also got married and was having my first baby. And then when I went on maternity leave, I realized that I didn't want to go back to work. Yeah. And I wanted to spend the first year at home with my baby. Which I did. I had the privilege to be able to do that, which I understand that so many mothers don't. And then after a few years, I realized that it was time for me to get back to work and that I wanted to do something that I really loved. But it wasn't me that actually knew what I wanted to do. It was my husband.
Really?
Who, you know, noticed my strengths, my flair for, you know, beautiful things and creativity and hosting, meticulous planning. And he actually suggested that I become a wedding and event planner, which was a totally new concept in this part of the world. Mm-hmm. It was actually unheard of. And I spent the first few years of building my name and my career trying to explain to people why they need to hire a planner. Because typically weddings in the Middle East are planned and organized by the family.
So what were some of your elevator pitch lines when it came to, you need me, you just don't know you need me?
Well, it was, you know, it was really, really difficult because it was a lot of explaining to people how, you know, I have the expertise, I have the time, I know things that you don't know. I do this for a living. And, you know, once you do this over and over again, it saves you a lot of time and money.
Well, yeah, think about the contacts for
exactly.
One thing, or, you know, being able to shortlist. I mean, we're so lucky here when we think about how many beautiful locations we have.
Of course.
But for someone who's been to them all and had events there, and when you speak to a couple and say, you know, what do you want? What's the What's the size? What's the feel? What's the aesthetic? For you to go, okay, well, you don't need to think about half of those places. In fact, here's probably five that you could look at instead. That's
exactly.
Saving people time.
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of times I think one of the common mistakes that couples make is booking their venue before hiring a planner. Mm. A lot of times they end up actually booking the wrong venue for their size or their format. And, you know, we know things that, you know, someone that has never done a wedding before doesn't know. We know what works. We know that this venue can hold that many number of people, that this venue can work with the aesthetic that you're trying to create. So, you know, we add a lot of value. And at the end, we also end up saving you money mm-hmm. and time and allow you to enjoy that experience and that process without having to stress or worry about the nitty-gritty details, because that's then our job.
So it becomes your stress. Are you ever off duty? Is your phone on fire?
I am never off duty. I am 24/7. One of the first things I tell my clients is I am available 24/7, and I do mean it, because I do understand, because people's lives are hectic mm-hmm. and most of our couples, they work themselves. They might not be able to get to the planning or get to speak to me or have their meetings until after they are done working. Mm-hmm. So I have to be as flexible as possible, meaning weekends, after hours, late nights.
And presumably a lot of these couples might not even be based in the same time zone as you.
Exactly, exactly, which happens quite often. Mm-hmm. So I do have to take that in mind. And when you know, they sign that dotted line, they have me and all of me 24/7.
Wedding planner extraordinaire Zeynep Alsaleh is with us today. She has been working in the industry for decades. She's got a new book out called A Carousel of Weddings from Dubai with Love. The wedding market is big business, but it can be a big headache for people if they haven't got the right planner or indeed are taking on too much themselves. So it can bring out the worst in people. And I've seen some pretty explosive conversations in my time as a wedding celebrant. Zeynep, what about any mishaps or disasters that you've had on the day?
I think, you know, touching on the bridezillas, I think given, you know, the number of years I've been doing weddings for and the people I've worked for, bridezillas are made and not born. So I think most of the time, bridezillas are frustrated, unheard, mm-hmm. and I would say tired brides.
Okay.
If you are working with the right planner, then you will not have to deal with any of these emotions, because technically that's the job of the planner, is mm-hmm. to absorb all of that and to give the bride the time and space, whether it is to vent or to express concern or worry. It's an emotional time.
Hugely. And, I mean, you're talking earlier about, you know, the family pressures that can be there. And, you know, you've got all this kind of, you know, people getting into their wexercise and, you know, the aesthetics of,
yes.
of them and their space. I wanted to ask you about guest lists, because this can be a huge issue. How do you advise couples when it seems like their families might be taking control and the list is getting out of control?
I think what I've always told my couples is that they need to have two lists. So you need to have an A list, and that list should have absolutely everyone that needs to be at the wedding. So, of course, family members, really close friends, before activating your B list. Your B list are, I'm not going to call them spares, because that's not nice when we don't have spare guests, but people that could perhaps not have to be invited because there are priorities when it comes to your guest list. And only after you've gotten your first set of RSVPs and knowing what your numbers look like, do you then start to invite other people, because we have had situations where people had invited a lot more than the capacity of their venue, only to end up with double the capacity in a venue that cannot hold that many people. And, you know, with these physical parameters, what do you do?
And they're there for safety reasons.
Exactly. There are safety reasons. So, you know, we will have to scramble, basically, to redesign
and feed.
Reformat the entire wedding to be able to accommodate that number of people.
What's the biggest wedding you've done?
1,500.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
Now, the couples that I'm about to talk about are not in Dubai, but I can tell you about a couple of mishaps I've had when I've been performing wedding blessings. Mm-hmm. We had one where the bride was, and I'm not exaggerating, an hour and 40 minutes late.
I'll blame the planner.
I blamed her attitude, but okay. And I had one where we were in the sun when we perhaps shouldn't have been for too long. And we had a bridesmaid fainting, hitting the deck.
Oh,
but you know what? I mean, it rained on my wedding day. That's, you know, all these things. I think the other thing is, whenever I think about wedding planning, it really is only as stressful as you make it. And I think our expectations as a couple can really get in our own way. And really, we might have thought about things, you know, the tiniest details. But on the day, people really, the priorities are who are you
100%.
With, great food, good music, you know, and only we know what we wanted. Only we know what that vision was.
Exactly. I mean, you know, a lot of times people get kind of hung up on the idea of what they want their wedding to be like or feel like. But my advice is to always, you know, remember the people are there to celebrate you.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you are there, as long as you are happy, as long as you are creating your own vibe and experience, no one's going to miss those little details. Like you said, Helen, you're the only one that knows about them.
No one is.
And I think one of the trends that we're seeing emerge now with weddings is curated experiences, because people will always remember how they felt attending a wedding, mm-hmm. and not necessarily how the wedding looked like and how beautiful it is, because you could attend the most beautiful wedding, and if the experience is marred for whatever reason, whether it's the entertainment or the F&B component or the weather, people are uncomfortable, the service isn't great, then no one's going to remember how beautiful that wedding they attended was. All they'll remember are those things that made them feel uncomfortable.
Very true.
So I think, you know, priorities are shifting. And it's always about the experience, and it's always about how people feel.
Claudia's saying, my brother-in-law was in charge of our music at the wedding. After our first dance, our choice of song, the DJ opened the dance floor with a then popular song, If You Want to Be Happy for the Rest of Your Life, Never Make a Pretty Woman Your Wife. I say no more. Ouch. What advice do you give to couples on the day in terms of them enjoying that day? Because it's not just about the guests.
No, of course. I think first and foremost that from the beginning, the wedding should be about them. They should not be planning a wedding for other people. It should really reflect who they are, reflect their personalities, and reflect their priorities.
Mm-hmm.
So not saying that they should not care about what their families want, because it's always nice to include family members. But first and foremost, it really should be about what they want. They have to decide together what it is that they want to achieve from their day. What do they like? What are their priorities? Whether, you know, maybe entertainment is their thing. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, the way the wedding is going to look like is what they're more focused on. And, you know, they can be a little bit selfish, I think. And I think the key is for them to really put together a day that reflects them, so that they can feel comfortable and not feel like I attended my wedding, but this was not my wedding. It was what my mother wanted or
someone
my mother-in-law
else's vision.
Wanted. Exactly.
What if someone comes to you with a vision or an aesthetic that you think is, I don't want to say gross, but it's like undesirable, not to your aesthetics, I know.
Not to my aesthetic. From day one, I have never done a wedding that I haven't proudly shared, whether on our website or social media channels or in the press, because I don't believe that I should do anything that doesn't represent me first and foremost. So if I am not convinced, I am not going to do that wedding, because at the end of the day, it's a reflection of me and my aesthetic as well. And if I'm not convinced, I'm not going to be like, well, this is their wedding. This is what they want it to look like.
Well, your heart wouldn't be in it, really.
No. And my heart needs to be there. And not just from that perspective, Helen. I need to also be able to connect with my couples.
Mm.
There needs to be chemistry, because I really need them to like me and trust me. And I need to like and want to be doing this for them, because it's a very intimate relationship. And it's a very personal event, and one that they will forever remember me by. So I know a thing or two that they might not know. I need to create a timeless wedding, one that they will remember forever and not cringe if they look at.
Can I ask you about Dubai then as a destination? What makes it so popular? And I don't want to say, you know, what some of your favorite venues, but maybe some of your, I don't know, different parts of town or places that you think are doing really well right now.
Well, first of all, I think, you know, like, being raised in Dubai, I've lived here all my life. So I have a, you know, like a love affair with Dubai. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to weddings, I think, you know, Dubai is one of the perfect destinations for weddings for a few simple reasons. First of all, the weather during the winter months, where it's too cold anywhere else in the world, we have beautiful weather for a good 6 to 7 months. So anybody wanting to get married between the months of November and April, what better location than Dubai?
I mean, mine was 1st of November and we had rain, but it was nice.
Yeah, but
it was fine.
But, you know, when it rains in Dubai, it's not like in the UK, for example, when it's pouring.
It was 10 seconds and I'd given everyone a pashmina as a gift. So everyone sat there with their pashminas.
Exactly.
Over there. But again, that was a moment.
It was a moment. And, you know, and then safety is a big thing.
Definitely.
Coming out of, I think, you know, whether it is physical safety or, you know, health or, you know, coming out off the heels of the COVID years, mm-hmm. that's a big thing for people. And making sure that the facilities and the hospitals and the attention to cleanliness and things like that have become a big priority for people. The venues that the city has, whether they're beach venues or city venues or desert venues, the possibilities are endless. The level of service and luxury that the city offers, I think, is unparalleled. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the culture. It's a melting pot. So wherever you're from, rest assured that you are going to be able to give your guests that authentic experience. The food scene in Dubai is like
just about to say that
is like unbelievable at the moment.
What's been some of your, and we've only got a minute left, but what in terms of the food that you've seen at weddings? I mean, we did roast dinners and then we had a shawarma station at midnight.
Yes. That's a big one.
Yes, that's a big one. I was going to ask you, what's been popular on the food front?
So lately, I think when it comes to food, you know, like food stations are a big thing. And because, you know, they're just so much fun and entertaining. And it also doesn't have that monotonous kind of rhythm to the night. Mm-hmm. So anything from sausage stations, you know, fish and chips, burgers, taco stations, ice cream, crepe, you name it. Food is a big thing right now in weddings.
Thank you so much for your time. It's been really, really interesting to kind
Thank
of get
you,
a bit
Helen.
Of behind the scenes.
Thank you for
Founder
having me.
Of Carousel Events, Zeynep. The book is available now. It's in collaboration with Dubai Tourism. It's absolutely gorgeous. So lots of inspiration in there. And if anyone wants to follow you online, contact you about any upcoming events, what's the best way of getting in touch?
They can contact us through our Instagram page at @carousel_weddings_events.
Thank you so, so much. If you want those details, you can just send me the word wedding and I'd be very happy to connect you. It is Skin Cancer Awareness Month and the heat is soaring here in the UAE. So we need to have a bit of a check-in, remind ourselves about how much time we should spend in the sun and what we should all perhaps be doing every single day to protect ourselves. Dr. Shruti is with us today, specialist in the Department of Dermatology at the Al Barsha Medcare Medical Centre, here to take my questions and yours. How are you, Dr. Shruti?
I'm good, Helen. How are you?
I am well, thank you for asking. I'm curious, are we getting lots of skin cancer or suspected skin cancers coming through into clinic?
Yes, I would say suspected more because people are becoming more aware, and which is a good thing because mm-hmm. it's one of the cancers which can be so easily picked up and, you know, contained and which can prevent the spread. So yeah, I mean, people are becoming more aware, so that's a really good thing.
Good, is a good thing. Yeah. What's on your skin right now? Do you wear an SPF every day?
I do. I swear by SPF.
Right, so this is what I wanted to ask you, because I wear a tinted moisturizer and it's got SPF 40 in it, and I'm like, okay, I pat on the head for me. Yeah. Do I need to be wearing extra sun protection?
Correct, yes. Oh. You need to. So, see, sun protection is one is the SPF, which is, of course, the most important factor. So the American Academy of Dermatology recommends anything above SPF 30. Mm-hmm. But you also need to check in your sunscreen the UVA protection. Okay, so you need to see that it has a UVA +++, like, so, you know, you're protected against both the sun rays. So most of the tinted moisturizers, they don't have that UVA protection.
I'm going to Google it when we've got the news later. Yeah. But I mean, I would imagine, and please come at me on 4001 if I'm wrong, the majority of people listening today didn't put on sun protection this morning.
And that's really unfortunate. And so many of my friends, they tell me, you know, is it really important to use SPF? And, you know, the same way like my tinted moisturizer has, and I'm just using an SPF 15. I'm skin of color. I don't need, SPF. And the most funny thing is, how many layers of moisturizer and sunscreen do I put on my skin? I don't have so much time, you know?
Yes, but there's that.
But really, I mean, SPFs, of course, it has a big role in protecting your skin from skin cancer, but also in aging, you know, aging skin, you know, the sunburns, everything, it has a big role to play.
Also, not just the SPF, but, you know, being in the sun at certain times of day and for certain amounts of time. What are the guidelines in terms of sun exposure?
So the sun, they say that you should avoid going out in the sun between 10 to 4, like 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And mostly that's the guideline that says it. Yeah.
What are some, to your mind, are some of the big myths or misconceptions about skin cancer that you're seeing, whether that's on social media or from clients coming into clinic, doctor?
So the most common is, like I said, the skin of color can't get skin cancer, which is a big myth. So it's seen, of course, the incidence is lesser, but the progression and, you know, how scary it is, it progresses faster in the skin of color, and it's more aggressive if it occurs in the skin of color. Second of all, most common myth is, you know, that if I use SPF, I'm okay, I don't need additional protection, which is also not right. So SPF protects you, but it's not 100%. No SPF is 100%. So you need to seek shade. You need to prevent going out in the peak, you know, the 10 to 4 time. Then the other one is, you know, it's okay for kids to tan. It's okay for kids to go out in the sun and become red. No, I mean, of course, kids, you won't be able to see the results so fast, but they will eventually grow up and you'll be able to see, you know, the effect of the redness, which will progress. And what else?
What about sunbeds?
There was
an incident in the UK just recently. A 43-year-old woman was diagnosed with a particular type of skin cancer due to sunbeds. Now, I'm embarrassed to admit this. Sunbeds were a big thing in my teens and 20s, I may have dabbled. I thought they were kind of not a thing anymore.
So, you know, because they are in an enclosure, so the amount of UVA and UVB that is in the sunbeds is way more than what you would get naturally. So that's a big myth, that sunbeds are okay and, you know, they won't cause cancer.
What about demographics that perhaps are more at risk? I mean, we can talk about, you know, nationalities or skin types and colouring, but what about, I don't know, any medications or, you know, are there anything that we need to be aware of in that respect, doctor?
So, of course, the family history is very important. You know, if you've had a family history of skin cancer, then there are certain genetic conditions which are more prone to skin cancer, you know, like if you have I would not go in the details, but, you know, if there's a genetic tendency, then, of course, you know, if you've had more moles, then your chances become more because they are the ones that can progress to become skin cancer. And, of course, the ethnicity plays a big role. Caucasian skin, you know, type 1, type 2 skin, which is the white skin that tan, that does not tan, that becomes red in the sun.
The Celtic.
Correct. So that's more prone.
Yeah. A message here saying, I'm covered head to toe and I wear niqab as well. So my face is covered. Do I still need SPF?
Your face is also covered. Okay. And your hands?
Don't know about hands.
Yeah. So anything that comes in direct contact with, you know, the sunlight, whether it's hands or the forehead, at least, you know, you should put SPF on the exposed parts.
Okay. Now, I wanted to ask you about those red flags when it comes to spotting skin cancers. And as you said, and fantastic that people are coming in to have moles checked and any differences. So for anyone listening today, what are maybe a bit of a checklist for assessing our own skin before we come to see an expert like you?
So that's very important. First of all, you need to do a self-examination. So you need to see all the parts, you know, you need even a back mirror to see your back. and then notice all the moles. If there's a new mole, then we call it the ABCDE. So you see the asymmetry, that is if the both sides of a mole are similar, you know, are symmetric. Border, if you know it's a regular border. Color, if you see different colors within the same mole. Diameter, if it is more than 0.6 mm, that is, you know, the back of a pencil. If it's bigger than that, you need to get it checked. And elevation, of course, you know, if it is elevated.
That's right.
And, you know, if there's sudden change, if there's bleeding or anything like that, then you need to visit your dermatologist and get it checked.
Is that something that you do? Would you do mole mapping and removal?
Absolutely.
We've had a message saying, where can we find good dermatologists who specialise in skin cancer prevention? I've always been so surprised that most dermatologists in Dubai are mostly aesthetic specialists, despite the unrelenting sunshine.
Oh, you can come to me.
Okay. I will send you number ending 884, Dr. Shruti's details. So when someone's coming in, are you able to... Do you do it by eye? Is there a gadget that you use?
So, of course, the eye is very important, but the most important is something we call as a dermoscope. So it kind of magnifies it and we're able to take pictures with it. And we see, you know, with experience, the different, you know, changes that we need to see. And of course, if something is really suspicious, we need to, you know, remove it with the margin and send it out for biopsy to see the changes.
Dr. Shruti with us this afternoon. She is a specialist in the Department of Dermatology at MedCap in Al Barsha. A message here saying, my daughter had a birthmark at birth, which has since faded. Do I need to be extra careful with that area of skin?
Extra careful in terms of sun exposure? Yes. I mean, see, most of these melanomas, they develop from, you know, the benign moles that we call. So yes, you need to be more careful. Yeah, that's all. And the regular things, not something, you know, extraordinary. Also depends on the skin type, also depends on your family history. So
what should we be looking for in, let's say, which I'm hoping to this weekend, I'm going to the beach.
Okay.
What should we be looking for in good sun protection, and how much should we be using?
Right. So that's the most asked question. So as I told you, most important is, you know, the SPF and the UVA. So anything above SPF 30, UVAA plus. And if you're going out in the sun, try to go, you know, especially at the beach, try to have a physical sunscreen. So look for ingredients like zinc oxide and titanium. How much to use? So typically for the face and neck, you use two finger breadths. So like you put a thick line on your first finger, thick line on your second finger, and then you put it on your face and your neck, or a shot glass full of sunscreen.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
What about reapplication?
Yes. So it needs to be reapplied every 2.5 to 3 hours, depending on what kind of SPF you're using.
Can I ask, a lot of people asking for your details, by the way. Can I ask about zinc sticks? Because that's what I use on my kids. They have like a 50 spray that I, you know, all over them.
Yeah.
And then I put, they often wear a hat, they sometimes don't wear a hat.
Yeah.
I do zinc stick on the tops of their cheeks, their noses. Would that count as a good physical barrier?
Yes, that's good.
Okay. They just like the colours. I'm not going to lie. That's what they're like. Message here saying, how early can you start using vitamin C? Can a 13-year-old start wearing vitamin C due to freckling to improve SPF efficacy?
Mm. Wow, when I was 13, I never thought about that.
Yeah, but this is the TikTok generation, Dr. Shruti. They know way more about skincare.
So there's no particular age that when you can start SPF 13. I mean, the vitamin C, 13 is fine, but it's just that vitamin C is not for everybody. So if you have skin which is sensitive, skin which is more prone to acne, don't use it. Always see a dermatologist before you start any new skincare.
We're not on Facebook Live today, so people can't see your amazing skin. But I'm curious.
Oh, thank you.
I'm not going to ask you how old you are, but I am curious. What does your skincare routine look like as a dermatologist?
So, of course, it starts with cleansing, moisturization, sunscreen, reapplication of sunscreen. Like if you wear makeup to work, I always use the sunscreen brush so that, you know, you can reapply because it's obviously difficult putting it again. But yeah, reapplication and night, of course, cleansing, retinol and or glycolic acid, and then moisturizer. Very simple and sorted.
It's working for you.
Thank you.
Where can people find you, Dr. Shruti?
So I'm at the Medcare Medical Center at Al Barsha.
If you want those details, just send me the word doctor and I will send you those over. But hey, we have a number of people wanting to ask about mole mapping, and I think it's very, very hard to get an idea on the SMS. So If you want those details, I just send me the word doctor. I will send you Dr. Trutti's info so you can contact her direct. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much,
I'm going to go and reapply my sunscreen. Actually, I'm not. I'm going to show you the link of what I'm using just to make sure I'm on the right track. Fantastic. Thank you so, so much.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis or treatment.
It is Mental Health Awareness Month, so instead of a deep dive into a topic or issue that we often discuss with Dr. Thuraya, clinical psychologist, this week in the Psychology Hour, we're talking about some tried and tested methods, the techniques or, well, even product recommendations to boost your mental well-being based on her years of practice and, of course, the latest data too. So while we get Dr. T set up, I'm going to read out some of the messages that we've had on 4001. So with Patrick, in pure plug alert, a little bite of camel milk chocolate goes a long way in brightening up a tough day. Jennifer recites her mantra, anxiety is a misuse of imagination. Oh my goodness, I'm using that. Salvador, to boost my mental health, I'm aware and enjoy the present moment, not thinking about the past or future. And for Premi, it's meditation and long walks, beach and boating. Dr. T, how are you?
I'm good, Helen. How are you?
I'm really well, really, really well. And annoyingly, I think I know why. I think I know why my mental health is in good shape right now. Because I've had two early nights. So when we're going to be identifying some things that have a genuine impact on how we feel, I'm guessing sleep's probably on the list.
Mm-hmm. Sleep is definitely on the list, and not just on the list. I would say top four on the list. Ooh. I mean, having that consistent sleep routine or proper sleep hygiene, creating a comfortable sleep environment, and, you know, making sure that you have sufficient amount of sleep has actually been found to increase that positive emotional responses to stressors and increase positive emotions in general. So there are so many studies that show how brain scans, you know, that the amygdala is actually about 60% more emotionally reactive in people who were sleep deprived, which basically means that you are more likely to react in emotionally charged ways.
Yes.
60% more than individuals who are not sleeping well.
No doubt. No doubt. And not to say I'm foul when I'm tired, but I would definitely say my fuse is considerably shorter. It's funny you mentioned there about having consistent sleep. I haven't got a consistent sleep routine. I've just said I've had two early nights, but that's good enough for now. That is good enough for now. Dr. T, we are going to be delving through your tried and tested little black book of things to do. Okay. Before we get to that, though, I'm curious, because it is Mental Health Awareness Month, what are some of the common misconceptions that you often encounter, whether it is through, you know, social media posts from purported experts or even in practice from clients about mental health?
I would say the biggest one has to do with personality character. So it's usually, you know, if you have mental health difficulties, that means you are weak in personality or not strong enough to deal with emotions and so on and so forth. But more than anything, and I think this is really the problem of somebody whoever created, like, you know, the phrase mental health, but it's the idea that mental health exists outside of physical health, which is absolutely inaccurate. There's no such thing as mental health without physical health. And I would say, if anything, that is the biggest misconception about mental health.
That's really, really interesting, because it all feeds in together. And thank you for acknowledging that, because I think there is this certainly stigma, taboo, misconception that anyone who says they're struggling with their mental health in any capacity or any severity is showing a sign of weakness. It's not. It's simply part of being human, that you are going to have days where you feel great, you feel capable, you feel proactive and positive. There's going to be days where you feel sad and low energy, and there will be times where that mental health is, you know, in need of some special attention, and that might be medical, it might be personal. So we're all kind of operating on a spectrum that changes all the time. So let's talk then about healthy lifestyle. So exercise, nutrition, sufficient sleep, those factors for impacting mental well-being. You mentioned you had a top four that sleeps in. What else is on that list?
Actually, from top four, I have sleep is number one, and then nutrition, so food intake, and then exercise, and then breathing/meditation. Those are my top four, and those I cannot tell you how much I drill into all of my clients, which they probably hate me for many times. But in reality, those four are key. So we've already talked a little bit about sleep. But when it comes to having a balanced diet rich in nutrients can really positively impact your mental health. Because, you know, if I want to get a little bit into the biology, when we talk about the autonomic nervous system, part of the autonomic nervous system is the enteric nervous system, which is our gut, which we know is our second brain. And 50% of our dopamine, 80% of our serotonin, and 100% of our GABA is produced in the gut. So if you're not eating well, you sure in heck are not going to feel well. So there are a lot of nutrients like omega-3 fatty acids, B vitamins that have been linked to improved brain function and mood regulation. And all of the different things that we eat are going to affect how our body functions and how we feel. I mean, something as basic as caffeine. Most people that come to me that feel a sense of anxiety, you know, I ask them, how many cups of coffee do you drink a day? They're like, oh, not much, just about two cups of coffee, one tea at night, but like black tea or green tea. And I'm like, that's a lot of caffeine for a person who has anxiety. So something as basic as that can make such a big difference in the way that we process our mood during the day.
That's really, well, I think there's kind of two things to examine there. And yes, that is what the food is doing to your system. And that mind-gut connection, we're seeing so much more research about that. So you can be going down that kind of probiotic, you know, your kefirs and your kombuchas and all that kind of stuff for your microbiome. But there's also the generally having a good diet. So, you know, your fish and your chicken and your whole grains and your dark, you know, green leafy veg. And yes, your camel milk chocolate, Patrick. But there's also this idea of taking care of yourself through food. Does that make sense? That when that you're kind of nourishing yourself, and when you're taking care of yourself, surely that must be create a kind of nice cause effect loop.
Of course. And you know, one of the things that I hear a lot from my clients, they say things like, oh, I'm going to stop carbs, or I'm going to stop sugar. I'm like, no, that's not how this works. Because when you are removing things from your diet that you actually enjoy, that's not healthy for your mental space and just enjoying life. When we talk about a balanced diet that's rich in all the things that you actually need, we mean balanced. We're not talking about severe intermittent fasting because you want to lose weight. We're not talking about keto diets. We're not talking about removing things. From a mental health perspective, what we are looking into is what is actually helpful from a balanced perspective, because balance is key to life in many different ways, not just when it comes to our diet, but even in how we think, how we live, and how we react to certain things.
Dr. Thrive is with us today, clinical psychologist from the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. And to mark Mental Health Awareness Month, we're asking you, inviting you to share what works for you. No name saying eat, pray, sleep, and let go, knowing that some factors are out of our control. Raj saying, I practice two things for mental well-being. Keep the phone away from 9 p.m. until 8 a.m. And secondly, acceptance over expectation, whether it's from your kids, spouse, friends or family. Lastly, just enjoy what you have rather than comparing to others who might have more. These are some of the mantras I follow to have my own happy space. You guys are so wise. I really appreciate you getting in touch, because there's some really interesting ideas. And as I said, you might do something that might benefit someone else, and vice versa. Kareem saying, charity. It's a pillar of Islam, but everyone should be more giving. Never miss an opportunity to be kind. Whereas for Chris, it's a comedy podcast. Laughter is infectious. Dr. Thuraya, clinical psychologist, joining us live as we mark Mental Health Awareness Month by not deep diving into some of the issues that we often do at this time during the week, but talking about some really practical, tried and tested things that you can do, change, incorporate into your life to boost your mental well-being. And I'm loving the messages that we're getting from you about what you've woven into your routine and what you've got in your toolkit when you need it. Dr. T, are you ready to give your verdict on some of these messages?
Let's do it.
Patrick saying, I find yoga a great start, and definitely clean diet 85% of the time. Exercise. Everyone is different. Live and laugh. Nothing is bad for you. And Dr. T is so right. So eat a little bit of chocolate, just not every day. So a kind of great, well-rounded approach there. No name on this one saying, I practice gratitude to get my anxiety state out of fight or flight mode. Is that something that we're hearing more and more about, you know, the importance of gratitude just for well-being? But is there anything that happens in the brain when you are practicing gratitude? Can you be stressed and grateful at the same time?
Well, I think in general, what we talk about when we're in a fight or flight is that first you have to regulate the body. So essentially what you're trying to do is those breathing exercises, the meditative state that you need to be in order to start to think of what you're grateful for, can be very helpful for your fight or flight response. So it's basically deactivating your sympathetic nervous system and really turning on the parasympathetic nervous system. So essentially, when you are practicing gratitude, you're creating neural pathways that are far stronger, especially when you repeat it over and over again, far stronger than the neural pathways that are geared towards negativity and essentially protection from any potential threat.
Wow. Okay. It's in the science. Dan says, dancing around the kitchen. You feel like an idiot for the first 10 seconds, though. Yeah, me and my friend Rachel, when we lived together, we used to brush our teeth at the same time and do what we call big shapes. So basically just doing ridiculous dancing, throwing your limbs all over the place. It's impossible to be sad when you're throwing big shapes. And Jamila saying time in nature and outdoors, and Pratusha echoing your point earlier, saying on the text line, annoyingly, it's sleep. Let's talk about relationships, Dr. T. There's been all sorts of weird and wonderful, maybe some rooted in science studies about, you know, who's happiest? You know, are you happiest if you're single or if you're married? So I'm curious, what role does social support, but maybe more impactfully, positive relationships play in good mental health?
Quite a lot, actually, because, you know, it not only helps you provide a sense of belonging and reduce kind of feelings of loneliness, but it also acts as a buffer against stress because you have somebody to talk to and kind of let that out. So prioritizing nurturing meaningful relationships and spending time with loved ones can be extremely beneficial. And it's not that, you know, we're not looking at this from who's happier, but we are looking at it from a perspective of, you know, the greater your levels of social support, the actual, and there are so many studies that show this, the less likely you are to experience depression and anxiety in severe cases or in intense ways. So the more likely you have that social support, the more likely you are to minimize the intensity of whatever mental health difficulties you go through, because you know that there's a sense of belonging. You know that there are people that care about you. There is that sense of accountability as well. You know, and we see this time and time again where people, when they think, you know, really dark thoughts about themselves, they tend to care a lot about what would happen to those that are around them and their loved ones if anything negative happened to them. So these are all very strong protective factors. But more than anything, what we find is that having that social support and that sense of connection to other individuals can be extremely beneficial for a reduction in stress, reduction in cortisol stored in the body, and an increase in feelings of, you know, oxytocin gets released, so feelings of, like, you know, happiness and a sense of connection to others.
Connection was exactly the word I was just searching for. Because some people find that in marriage, some people could be married and be incredibly lonely and unhappy. But if you're having connections with anyone, you know, a good friendship group, and I'm a firm believer in quality over quantity there, and having real friendship rather than just fleeting acquaintances, because that's when you can be yourself, when you can be open, when you can reach for help and you know, get back in return. And, you know, I thought Kareem's point earlier about charity, about never missing an opportunity to be kind is a really good one in this respect. And I get a huge amount of, you know, feel good from that as well. Let's catch up now with Neil. You can contact us on 4001 on the ARN Play app, the WhatsApp, or you can give us a call at 0487 15500.
Hi, Helen. This is Neil. How I like to take care of myself is daily ice baths. I found that having 5 minutes in a freezing cold ice bath every morning gives me that time to really focus. It builds mental fortitude. It creates a resilience that kickstarts the day. And I've been using a bath called Boreas Baths. They're available in Dubai. They're an awesome product, and it really helps build that strong foundation to the day. So I'd really recommend ice baths daily to anyone.
Ooh, this is a bit of a new thing, this kind of, you know, cold plunge therapy. But I mean, there are studies talking about, you know, it's got a calming effect that activates the vagus nerve, decreases stress levels. Have you taken the plunge, Dr. T?
I haven't taken the plunge yet, but I have done cryotherapy. And so it's similar, but not exactly the same.
And were you Were you soothed? Were you calm?
I don't think I've ever felt my skin so soft, to be honest.
Live on the line from the Human Relations Institute and Clinic is clinical psychologist Dr. Thryer, as we talk about some very practical, realistic ways of boosting your mental health. Dr. Thryer, some fantastic suggestions coming through on the text line. You're more than welcome to add yours to the mix on 4001. We've had everything from sleep to sunlight as well. Belinda's saying, gym. I still use medication, but having that me time to focus on myself has done wonders. And I say this as someone who is far from a gym bunny, but just finds lifting heavy weights brilliant. Good for you, Belinda. What about exercise? What about that movement, the endorphins that everyone talks about all the time, Dr. T?
Well, I mean, yes, you're absolutely right. Regular physical activity releases endorphins, which are our natural mood boosters, right? So it reduces symptoms of anxiety, of depression, it helps with our self-esteem, it helps with our cognitive functioning, but it also helps us feel a sense of belonging because we come from a gym and everybody kind of talks to each other, hopefully. At least. And so, you'd hope that people actually interact at the gym as well. But essentially what we find is that exercise actually changes the way the brain functions, which accounts for the decrease in depression and anxiety because of the neurotransmitters that it's utilizing and because of the release of endorphins. So more often than not, we find that any kind of like 3 to 5, 45 minute exercise sessions a week actually deliver optimal mental health benefits. But when it comes to individuals that are really struggling with their mental health, I tell them start small, 10 minutes every single day. And actually, I love one of the callers' suggestions, which is dance around the house, jump around. It really doesn't matter. Just get your heart pumping. And that in and of itself, 10 minutes every single day is more than enough from a mental health perspective to already reduce these kinds of intense feelings enough to get you to go to the gym. So just start small baby steps. Something is better than zero.
I think that's so true. You know, when we hear exercise, I immediately think of like gym bros and everyone in beast mode in the gym. And it's not. Sometimes it's just about moving more than you were before. Mm-hmm. No name on this one saying, having a clean and tidy house. Mess makes me very stressed. Plus going to my spin classes, yoga and swimming, and a long walk or bike ride at the weekend, preferably with my husband. Sanuj, you're right. He says, I can't believe no one has said pets yet. My cat really calms me down when I'm feeling stressed. That's nice. There's quite a lot of data around, you know, lowering anxiety and even heart rate when you're close to an animal, Sanuj. So thank you for flagging that. And a message here about Tai Chi. Amazing way to center yourself and escape the hectic life we lead. An anonymous message saying, my mental health practice is spirituality, hope, and also considering ideas like it's never always in my control and yes, I am enough. Meditation, Thryer. I've tried.
Are you cringing?
I've mostly failed. Yeah, because honestly, it feels like something that's on my to-do list and then I just feel worse. So talk to us about why everyone says it works.
Well, I mean, to be honest, meditation is not just one of the most significant parts of mental health, but it's the main reason, I would say, is because it actually gets us to pay attention to our body. We are so disconnected from our body on our day-to-day that we are not really paying attention. Now, a lot of my clients will say the same things that you are, Helen, which is like, ew, meditation, go away. And I tell them, it's fine. I don't need you to meditate for hours and hours on end. I just need you to sit at the edge of your bed every morning for 3 minutes. Start small, 1 minute, and then 2 minutes, and then 3 minutes, and then just up it a bit, and just pay attention to your body. That in and of itself is meditation enough for your body to actually, for you to reconnect to your body, and for you to have these like reduction in stress, anxiety, and depression moments. And more than anything, it helps you ground yourself from the excessive urgency culture, the speed of life that we're so used to when we work in a city like Dubai. So essentially what meditation really does is that it helps you become mindful. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, they think, well, in my meditation, I have to not think of anything. And I tell them that is exactly the opposite of meditation. Meditation is all about just allowing whatever needs to come in to come in instead of doing what we usually do best, throughout the day is ignore and distract and avoid and just push aside and like repress and suppress. And instead of that, just kind of observing what comes up for you, noticing what comes up, seeing how it affects your body. One of the worst things that we are experiencing as a society all around the world is that we're so disconnected from our body, and we need more embodiment practices in our life. Things like Tai Chi, phenomenal. Things like yoga is actually really good as well. But you don't have to go big. You can do something really small. Mindfulness, meditation practices at home are more than enough to get you just reconnected to yourself.
Okay, Thuraya, for you.
Come on, Ellen. I know you can do it.
I find guided meditations a lot more manageable, you know, where you are being encouraged to, you know, think about, I don't know, different body parts or, you know, all different circumstances. Like that to me feels a bit more palatable. When I am left to my own devices for 3 minutes, I will be doing a shopping list. I will be thinking about what I'm going to wear to brunch on Saturday afternoon. I will be putting together my kid's swimming bag in my head. I will. But maybe that's okay. And I just need to persevere. To the text line, Dr. Thuraya, no name on this one, saying, I have severe anxiety linked to past trauma. Medication has made a huge difference, but the right type. Also what I eat and obviously sleep too. But embracing different types of rest has helped as well. I took up knitting as it helps when I'm anxious. It gives me a focus and something to do with my hands without taking energy. And it helps regulate my feelings too. Heather, coming back to your point earlier, lots of protein, food quality magnesium and zinc. It does wonders for the brain. And yes, exercise, seeing people regularly, healthy food and meditation. Can I ask then about the dreaded work-life balance? How does that contribute to mental well-being, Thuraya?
Well, significantly so, but not in the way that people usually think about work-life balance. People usually believe that work-life balance is all about making sure that you give yourself enough time as you would at work, which is super ideal, but also extremely unrealistic. The idea when we talk about work-life balance in reality is to just give yourself time. Because like you said, Helen, you know, if you're not working, you're thinking of your kids, you're thinking of what you need to do for them, you're thinking of tomorrow, you're thinking of like maybe the next week, what play dates you want to. And so all of that is all the things you need to do. But in essence, you're not actually taking care of yourself. So work-life balance, in essence, is about giving yourself the same attention that you would something else. And it doesn't have to take an hour, 2 hours, or 3 hours a day. It could be 5 minutes. You could start small. But it's just about remembering that your body is like a machine. And if you don't feed it the same tender love and care and nutrition and exercise and proper sleep, it's not going to continue functioning in the way that you would want it to. So just give yourself a sense of love, you know, a sense of appreciation for your existence. That's what true work-life balance is.
Some compassion. Okay. To the phone line, loving the messages, guys, on what is boosting your mental health. And it can be something that is a daily practice for you. It could be something that maybe you just know you can go to when you really need it. And I was just talking earlier about how I struggle to meditate, but maybe Suman has some advice.
Hi, Helen. It's Suman here. And I am that person with a monkey mind, constantly juggling thoughts, tasks, and everything else in life. For me, I usually have a jigsaw puzzle on the go. For me, that's my calming activity that helps me to focus and keep my mind still, so to speak. Even 20 minutes a day makes me feel so much better. I've always loved a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm a firm belief that every home should have a puzzle on the go at any time. I actually started one at the weekend. So, Suman, I will admit, my phone often sits next to me, but maybe I'll put it somewhere else. And lastly, Thuraya, it wouldn't be complete without asking you this. Can you please maybe discuss the role of therapy or counselling in supporting mental health, whether that is someone who might find themselves in crisis or maybe it's just a case of keeping on top of how you're feeling?
I mean, you know, Helen, when we talk about therapy, it's a lot of people, they usually like, oh, you know, it's one of those things. But in reality, you don't really need to be suffering to go to therapy. It's kind of like preventative more than it is just reactive. So when we talk about therapy, it's about having a conversation with somebody who's not invested in your life at all. So it's not going to give you advice. It's not a person who's going to tell you what to do or judge you for what you've been doing. It's just a way for you to, you know, have that cathartic experience of releasing everything that you can in a safe space, and sometimes just leaving it there. And some, and I hear this a lot with a lot of my clients where they say things like, you know, I enjoy the fact that I can come and dump everything on you and then leave, and I don't have to take any of that with me. And that in and of itself can be so stress relieving. Mm-hmm. So just a reminder, I guess, to people is that therapy doesn't have to be something that you go to when, you know, things are really bad. It's just sometimes good to talk to somebody who's not invested in your life in the way that your friends and your family are.
Well said. Dr. Thorau, thank you so much. Really appreciate all of the information, the insights, the data and the ideas that have been coming in on the text line too. Stay well, and we'll catch up over the coming weeks. And you can, of course, find Dr. Thorau, clinical psychologist at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. As she's saying, it's good to talk. We also have the messages about music. And yeah, Dan, a bit of kitchen dancing as well. And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.